This is the Popmatic Podcast for March 9th, 2016. Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Amanda,
Mike, Master of the Elements,
Bill,
Jeremy Cantori.
What does that mean? I don't know what that means.
What's my name, Bill?
No, Jeremy Cantori.
Jim Cantori is the Weather Channel guy.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Cool.
That saves my joke for later.
I got it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Me and TV are like. Yeah, bosom buddies.
Jim Cantori on a sunny day.
Love TV. Can't watch enough of it.
If Jim Cantori comes to your town, you're going to get hit with bad weather.
That's right.
How that works.
Prepare to die.
Yes.
Speaking of Jim Cantori, we're recording this right in the middle of Severe Weather and Flood Preparedness Week in Tennessee. Say that three times fast.
That.
Who remembers the flood, people?
I remember.
Never forget.
And March is when the National Weather Service ramps up their spring safety campaigns. Who remembers the tornado, people?
I was not here then.
Oh, a couple weeks. I remember
that. Bill was here. Well. I've heard stories. They're good.
I will put in some links to help you prepare for floods and tornadoes and et cetera. Stay woke. Don't get drowned. Don't get blown away. On this show, weather.
Weather.
Are there any weather nerds here?
I'm a weather nerd.
Would you like to go first?
I would love to go first because I'm a weather nerd. So when I go to pick up weather books, I usually tend to lean more towards tornadoes than hurricanes. And I think that's just a product of where I grew up because in the landlocked Midwest, we're not so concerned with those monsters that grow over the Atlantic or Caribbean in the warm summer waters. But having exhausted most of NPL's collection of tornado books, I've recently moved on to reading about the ravages of Hurakan, who, you may know, is the Mayan god of wind, storm, and fire, and the genesis for the actual name Hurricane.
Of course.
So,
duh.
See, it's fun to learn while you deal with weather. So in August 1969, an innocent-looking group of clouds grew and evolved into a spiraling vortex of darkness and terror, and it headed towards the Gulf Coast. Her name, of course, was Camille. And in his book, Roar of the Heavens, author Stephen Bechtel tells the story of what is still the most intense storm to ever hit the United States mainland. For us, our frame of reference for bad storms is definitely Katrina, maybe Andrew if we go back a little bit farther. But Katrina was only a strong Cat 3 when she hit a little bit, almost in the same spot as Camille. She was just a little bit to the west. And to compare, Katrina's winds were 125 miles per hour when she came on shore, while Camille's sustained winds were measured officially at 175 miles per hour.
That's some NASCAR stuff.
Yeah, but most of the instruments that were actually used to measure these winds got blown away. So it happened, you know?
That powerful, huh?
What year was this?
1969. Oh. So some meteorologists argue that her winds were actually over 200 miles per hour, which they have pretty much said is about the maximum level that winds can be generated in a hurricane. The saving grace with Camille was that she was smaller than Katrina, so while the damage was massive, it wasn't quite as widespread as Katrina was. The interesting thing is after leveling the Mississippi coast and past Christian, where she came ashore, Camille moved inland and began to dissipate, dumping all her tropical rain on the mid-south states, Tennessee. But when she reached Virginia, all the elements in atmosphere kind of joined together in a like perfect once-in-a-thousand-year storm that inundated parts of rural Nelson County in Virginia. And on the night of August 19th, basically 9 months of rain fell in a 12-hour period. And this caused massive and unexpected mudslides. Like, they weren't really watching Camille because she'd already come ashore. And this wiped out two small towns and killed hundreds of people. So much rain fell in a short time in Nelson County that, according to the National Weather Service, it was probably the maximum amount of rainfall which meteorologists compute can be theoretically possible.
What?
It rained. They officially measured out of rain. Yeah, it can make no more rain.
Wow.
Walls of water.
That's what that Blind Melon song is about.
It was. So it officially measured 27 inches in 12 hours. But again, some argue that it was more than 31 inches because either the measuring devices didn't go above that or they got washed away. And just for comparison, the 2010 Nashville flood, which we had talked about, we received 19 inches of rain in 48 hours. So you're talking 30 inches in 12 hours versus 19 inches in 48. So
Jeez. It
was a lot of rain. So a couple of fun facts from the book. Camille came ashore on Sunday night, August 17th. And at that same time in upstate New York, a small music concert was happening just outside the city of Woodstock.
Oh, yeah.
It rained there as well, but they were unrelated systems.
That's what the Blind Melon song is about. They're chanting no rain. Killed those hippies are ruining everything.
Wrecking it for everybody.
Don't take the brown acid indeed.
The other story is of a massive hurricane party that if you've seen anything about Camille, you've probably heard the story. There was an apartment complex where they were having this big party that Camille entirely wiped off. All that's left is the foundation. But over time, this has been proved to be untrue. Apparently, there was no big party. There were actually three survivors from this building, not just one. And the lady who perpetuated the original story was later arrested and convicted of killing her 11th husband.
Whoa.
Wow. Then going on to marry 12 and 13 while she was in jail.
Some people just got it.
Yeah. Is she like a bit some sort of musk or something?
High quality human being.
This storm is like the template for the 70s like disaster.
It is. It's like the best thing ever. Wow. So Dr. Robert Simpson.
It's a cool, I don't know, best thing ever.
best thing, I don't know.
Best story ever?
I'm sure the people who died would disagree.
They're dead, so it's okay.
Oh, okay. Wow.
40 years ago.
You say I'm dark. Jeez.
Okay, so Dr. Robert Simpson of Saffir-Simpson scale fame compared Bechdel's book to my favorite, Isaac Storm. So when I saw that on the back cover of this book, I knew I had to read it. And I would agree with his assessment. This was a very entertaining and journalistic look at an awesome weather event. And it also made me happy that I don't live where hurricanes come from.
Wow. The hurricane can or hurricane? Anyway,
will you insert crickets there, please? My tumbleweed button is broken today.
Right, whatever. Philistines. In 1988, the song Kokomo by Beach Boys was everywhere. That same year, I spent a lot of time at daycare because my mom worked the night shift at a hospital and my dad worked during the day. So I would come home around nightfall every day. I guess it'd be around like 6-ish. Anyway, the kids and or teen chaperones would put on Kokomo on infinite repeat. For weeks on end.
We'll be falling in love to the rhythm of the steel drum band. Down in Kokomo,
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take it to Bermuda.
So much like Back to the Future and Green Beans, Kokomo started out something I kind of liked, but then due to infinite experiences at daycare, I retain a white-hot hate to this very day. Ugh. So my first thought when I hear the phrase Key Largo is... Bleep, you Beach Boys. deserve to die in obscurity.
It's not Montego.
Yeah, well, that's another film noir that I've been putting off starring, William Powell. this may be why I put off watching the excellent film noir that I just mentioned, the same name for decades. Key Largo.
Montego.
Oh, you're going to punch your face in Kokomo.
I would like to see that.
That's right. I'll take them all the way to Indiana because there isn't a Kokomo in the Florida Keys.
The only one is in Indiana.
Lies.
Podcast now.
It's from 1948 and it stars Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Edward G. Robinson, and Lionel Barrymore. Bogart plays Frank McCloud, a World War II vet who goes to a hotel in Key Largo, Florida to see the family of a friend of his who died in the war, much like The Guest, but with less violence. Bacall plays his friend's widow and Barrymore, his friend's mom. Things go pretty well. So well, in fact, he's invited to stay at the hotel, if you know what I mean, and I think you do. Until Edward G.'s Johnny Rocco and his goons stroll in and take over the hotel. Rocco hopes to meet an associate coming by boat from Miami. It seems to be in heavy denial that an approaching hurricane may delay his associate's plans. He's going to come any minute now, see? I think, in retrospect, it is meant to hint at Rocco's desperation, for he sees kicked out of Cuba for being a little too open with his criminality. And is eager to regain the favor of his mafia bosses. But it came off to me while watching it that he is unaware of how hurricanes work.
Hurricanes are bad.
Yeah, it's like, maybe we should stay in Nemo. Let's go outside and make sure the boat is here. Eventually, Rocco and company decide to huddle in the hotel, waiting out the storm. This escalates the already simmering tension. For you see, Bogart plays the standard hero archetype of a wisecracking, manly man pretending to be selfish but secretly cares about what's going on. Here his excuse is that he was too scarred emotionally at the war to actually help his new friends. Rocco continuously taunts him, even handing him a gun at one point, knowing that he actually won't do anything. Why one review I found calls Key Largo a noir Hamlet, and I can almost see it. The gangsters callously kick out a group of Native Americans who usually use the hotel for shelter during weather emergencies. They plead to be let back inside, but to no avail. Oh, no. So there's like some scenes where like they go outside and there's like this little group of like people in blankets being like continuously having water dumped on them. It's almost like those like when you see like weather reports and there's that one guy outside saying, like, it sure is raining. When the storm finally subsides, Rocco forces Frank into piloting a boat to meet his associates elsewhere. But it is there, spoiler alert, for a nearly 70-year-old movie. He makes a final stand, and in a very tense shootout that had me on the edge of my exercise bike seat. So I was exercising at the time. I had a very fun time, although there are some caveats. Much like Bruce Lee and Fists of Fury, Bogart takes forever to do anything. Ugh. I'm not here to see watch people getting beat up. Plus, I found that in older movies that you had to cut them some slack when it comes to pacing. This is 30-something years before MTV would ruin our patience. And lastly, this one is, shall I say, even slower than most older movies. Like a slow-mo montage of a snail racing molasses going uphill, slight kind of slow. Am I right, Bill?
Right.
Right.
According to Wikipedia, a dust storm is a meteorological phenomenon common in arid and semi-arid regions. Dust storms arise when a gust of front or other strong wind blows loose sand and dirt from a dry surface, and it moves soil from one place and deposits it in another place.
That's also called a haboob.
Haboob!
Yeah!
I know I've got you on the edge of the seat.
I was.
Okay.
Riveted.
The Dust Bowl, also known as the Dirty 30s, was a period of severe dust storms that damaged ecology and agriculture that damaged the U.S. prairies and farmland of the 1930s. Out of this time came Dorothea Lange, and she was an influential American documentary photographer and photojournalist best known for her Depression-era work. I highly recommend some books that we have in the library. First off, Dorothea Lange, The Heart and Mind of a Photographer. This book is filled with photographs of Ms. Lange's work and her career, including the Dust Bowl photographs, and the book also has many thoughtful essays. Also, I found two juvenile books about Ms. Lange, Dorothea Lange, Life Through a Camera, or Dorothea Lange, A Life in Pictures. Both are for juveniles, however, I think if you're an adult, you will like them too. For those more curious, just to give you an idea of who Dorothea Lange was and her work, she's probably best known for her photograph called Migrant Mother.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was the picture that she made.
It's a haunting photograph of a 32-year-old mother of seven. She looks about 50. It shows her with two of her children. She's also holding a baby, and two of her children are hiding their face. And this photograph captured what the Dust Bowl era was like. So, Dorothea Lange. And to Brian.
Man, that was happy, Bill. You really brought up the mood.
Yeah.
Maybe
I can. Well, that's why I'm here.
We got people dying. We got Brian Wilson's mental illness.
That's right.
We're going to continue along this vein. Welcome to the Pop-matic Dreadcast. So,
that's what we do.
So, during May 1st and 2nd, 2010, Nashville received an unprecedented 13.57 inches of rainfall. Is that the stat that you had?
I said the highest one I found was 19.
Okay, so
that might have been outside of Nashville proper.
Okay.
I did hear Nashville was 13.
So in 2 days.
Almost 20 inches, probably.
Let's average. Let's say 15 inches of rain.
Over the area.
It was crazy. I remember that weekend very well. Mm-hmm. My partner was out of town, and I was home alone reading The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, that's a bad book to read when the weather gets bad.
Which is very appropriate.
Which is about, like, a environmental disaster, which then basically causes the collapse of society.
I watched The Road, like, a month and a half later. Only a few days after my son was born on Father's Day.
Awesome. Great.
With my father-in-law.
And it was so strange because that novel, if there's any novel that's a horror novel but gets interpreted as literature, it's The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
Just totally filled me with fear and dread. And clearly something was going on outside in the environment that was not normal. Like, it was just so weird and scary. So that's my flood memory, but really, that's really kind of wimpy compared to a lot of the other amazing, dangerous, and tragic things.
How about being stuck behind a wall of water and being without power for over a week?
So compared to many of the other flood stories that happened. So if you wanted to learn about the other flood stories that happened during the 2010 flood, you could go to the Special Collections Department 2010 Flood Digital History Project. So the 2010 Flood Digital History Project has many oral histories about the flood. And through our website, you can actually access them and listen to some of the best stories. For instance, like this little bit from Matt Pilkus' oral history.
We were basically trapped in a bend of the river. I-40 is traveling east-west, and the bend of the river came north-south over us, and here we are, trapped in between. So we were on an island. Well, there were two young ladies that were from, I believe it was the Memphis area, and they were in a Jeep Commander, which is a large SUV. They were on a road trip to Miami because they were going to go on a cruise. Well, they were adamant that they felt like their Jeep Commander could make it through that water. Anytime somebody that you see on a public service announcement on television, when they tell you don't go through water if it's over your tires or if it's up to the bottom of your car, don't do it. They're right. Mm-hmm. Cars float. Mm-hmm. Throw an aluminum can in the water, it floats. It's the same thing. When I had my back turned, because we were out of our vehicles by now, standing around what to do, and they decided that they were just going to punch it and they were going to go through the water. Well, this water was probably now about half a mile across. It was a river. Mm-hmm. They weren't just driving across a street. You know, they were going to have to drive about half a mile through standing water, which eventually they got about halfway, and their car died. The Jeep died because it was flooded. Well, I'm standing there, and I'm looking, and I'm watching, and slowly you see the Jeep start, it gets picked up. The front end, I guess because the engine block starts to tip down, the back end goes up in the air, kind of a reverse Titanic. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, people are starting to scream. You see them jump out of their windows, which were rolled down, and they start to float away toward in the Harpeth River.
All right, so if you want to hear the end, how that ends, you got to go and check out the 2010 flood digital history page. There's many other stories, not just stories of rescues, but community coming together, uplifting stuff. It's really interesting. There are pictures, too. So, Jeremy, can you help us recover from this natural disaster?
Let's lift this cloud cover through the help of song. When you think about Electric Light Orchestra, you probably think about spaceships, frontman Jeff Lynne's gorgeous mane of hair, or Olivia Newton-John roller skating in disco heaven. But Jeff Lynne is kind of the Jim Cantore of rock and roll, using catchy melodies and conceptual song cycles to warn listeners about the dangers of rain, lightning, and other strange phenomena from the sky. Phenomena. From the sky.
Phenomena. Phenomena.
Very good. First, there's Laredo Tornado from 1974's El Dorado. El Dorado is a concept album about a man whose fantasies help him escape his mundane reality, and the cover features a photo of Dorothy Gale's ruby slippers. Now, The Wizard of Oz is an inductee in the Weather Nerds Hall of Fame for its contributions to meteorological representation in motion pictures, and Laredo Tornado was the song which was played as the film took the stage to accept its award. That's a true story. On the sunnier side, there's also Above the Clouds from 1976's A New World Record. This song is so uplifting that it practically lifts the listener up to the location of the title. This is probably the only song in ELO's catalog, weather catalog, that is not about inclement weather. The centerpiece of the band's weather work is Concerto for a Rainy Day, which comprised all of side three of the double album Out of the Blue, which was released in 1977. This piece consists of four interconnected songs, beginning with Standing in the Rain, which features actual thunder and rain, recorded by Jeff Lynne outside his rented studio. Besides the real rain, there are cascades of keyboard chords falling down amidst the fury of operatic vocals. Truly, this is a musical translation of a storm. Big wheels.
I'm glad you got stuck in the schlock.
I can't say wheel and fill. I can't E and
wheel and fill.
I had a little trouble with oral history earlier. Yeah. I cut that part out.
Big wheels.
Keep this part in.
Big wheels fills the sky with sad gray clouds, while the breakdown in summer and lightning is like a rooftop dance party where inhibitions and unnecessary garments are shed in a downpour. This piece culminates in the inescapable joy of Mr. Blue Sky, which you've probably heard in a car commercial. Or,
this morning.
Yeah, see? Or if you've ever died on an operating table only to be revived later, you heard it in heaven. Out of the Blue may have marked the band's commercial peak, the peak of their commercial achievements, but Jeff Lynne still had a 30% chance of performing more weathery tunes. Fresh from anchoring the soundtrack to Xanadu, 1981 saw the release of Time, yet another concept album about a man who's transported to the year 2095. He falls in love with an IBM computer and longs for the simpler times of 1981. This album featured Rain Is Falling, which went all the way to number one on the Bubbling Under Hot 100 singles chart, which I swear I did not just make up. Finally, Jeff Lynne covered the classic of the American songbook, Stormy Weather, otherwise known as The Stock Market Had a Bad Day Music, from the radio show Marketplace. This song appeared on Jeff Lynne's first solo album, 1990's Armchair Theater, and was written by Harold Arlen and Ted Kohler. You may know Harold Arlen's name because he too was something of a Doppler dabbler, having co-written 1939's Over the Rainbow, which was in The Wizard of Oz. And now we're back where we started. All of this stuff is on Freegal. Check it out. Download it immediately.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my girl and I ain't been together. Keeps raining all the time.
wasn't even here.
this is a really like disaster movie episode.
Hey guys.
Hey Brian.
Hey Brian.
Hello Brian.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
We blow our nose.
Yeah. Well, we snort and we burp.
Maybe the library has it.
Look at this.
Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy. Amanda.
Thanks, Bill. Way to be responsible. So for this segment, I am going to continue my March weather madness with two series of fiction books. You know, it's fun to learn new things about the weather, but sometimes a girl just wants to curl up with a good book and read a good story. And if it involves the weather, more the better. Almost rhymed. I tried to make that rhyme, but that's all I got.
More the better.
So in 2003, Rachel Kane started a new series of books called The Weather Wardens. This was her first series, and I would still argue that it's her best. Later, she joined the paranormal romance phase with her popular Morganville vampire series. I have not read those, but I have enjoyed her weather books. Fiction books about the weather are hard to find, and trust me, I've looked. And the fact that I got a nine book urban fantasy series totally rocks. So the idea here is that a special group of talented individuals can control the basic elements of the earth, like fire, earth, and then weather. Wardens are also paired with captured djinn, or genies, that help them amplify their powers. Main character Joanna Baldwin is a powerful weather warden, jealous. Table for one. And somehow over the course of her travels, she falls in love with her djinn, David. This is kind of an unspoken no-no in Wardenland, but Joanna and David are so powerful that the wardens need them to help save the world. About seven books in, Kane adds a spin-off series of four books called The Outcast Season, which features fallen djinn Cassiel and her weather warden, Luis Roca. Roca is an earth warden this time, and together they go about saving his niece, who is kidnapped by an evil djinn and forced to unleash her powers at a young age. I didn't quite enjoy the Outcast Season as much as the Weather Wardens, but both were good. Also, you do have to read to the end of the Outcast Season, which ends after the Weather Wardens, in order to get a kind of a complete ending to the big story arc. My only complaint with these books is that Kane is very rough with her characters. They have to go through some pretty tough stuff. And the books are not really relaxing reads by any means. Also, I should note that you might need to ILL one or two of the series for a complete read. But I'm pretty sure I can find you a copy of anything you need to keep going. So if you are looking for a series with weather and genies and fast cars, check these out this spring while we wait for all the fun thunderstorms to come back.
Can I make one interjection?
Yes.
Here? It seems like you settled on a name for your month-long weather themed Tickle My Fancy segment.
Oh, you found a name?
And it is called?
Well, right now it's March Weather Madness. It might change, but that's what I settled on.
Hmm. I think this episode's going to be called March Weather Madness.
Nice.
For sure.
Cool.
I can remember the first time I saw this series on the shelf, and I was like, hey, have you read this? You're like, yes, of course.
I think, is the first one called Ill Wind? I think that's what the first one's called. We can double check that.
I bet there's an X-Men novel.
Sounds like Raising Storms
about Storm.
Or
you know?
I always want to be Storm, too. I think she's awesome.
It sounds sort of X-Men-y. I mean, not all the X-Men
it's a little,
have
yeah,
weather.
It's a little bit more focused than, like, X-Men has so many different ranges. This is all weather, nature-based.
There's an earthquake guy.
I don't want to talk about comic books, but Stan Lee's influence is big.
A startling coincidence. I actually read the first two books of the series.
Nice.
Yeah, I was.
I've corrupted you. I love it.
I was unknowingly
corrupted.
I was quite in an urban fantasy phase.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, you know, I'll try this out. And the first book, I was like, wow, this is obviously not written for me, but I like it. And the second book was like, oh man.
And I'm done.
Oh, so much about. Oh no, my djinn is in trouble. I need to save him. I need to come up with this special spell to save him.
I call it the reverse.
Ooh, sexy times.
Rewrite fan fiction.
I do remember there was a lot of like she would like want specific things, and I didn't know how to picture that. You know, like I like the specific handbag and the specific kind of shoe.
Yeah, you have to be a girl.
And the specific kind of car, and I'm all like, I don't know what any of this means.
I didn't really get the car. I mean, I just knew that they were fast special cars that were cool. So
and the afterword, I think she said she's a big gearhead or something.
Yeah, the author is.
Huh.
The covers usually seem like the characters on the covers seem like they're always like carrying a wrench or on a motorcycle.
Well, I mean, she wrecks so many cars over the course of like she gets a fast car and then something happens. She gets a fast car and something happens.
Yeah, gets blown up in the wind, I suppose.
Yeah. Mike?
So, not a lot happened to me this week, so I thought I'd dig up what I would have said if I'd flipped tails last week. It's like an alternate reality. Let's go fall back in time, gang. Ooh.
Wow.
Way back to what day is it? Oh, yes, March 1st. March 2nd. Longtime listeners will remember when I went gaga over the trailers for The Raid 2. Well, a new action movie trailer premiered recently that also got my adrenaline all a-pumping and a-thumping. Why, the Friday it premiered, I was so excited that I wasn't paying attention to where I was walking and nearly got hit by a car walking to the gym. This guy's like, hey, look over there. And I'm like, what movie? It's called Hardcore Henry.
Hello, Henry. Do you remember how you got here? This next part might hurt. Squeeze. You and I were, and still are, husband and wife. I love you, Henry. Henry, they want your technology.
How do I like the new you?
It's all right. I'm here to help you. There's a speech module installed. But at least we know you're not deaf. Okay, well, the good news is that you're going to live a while. The bad news is there's an army standing between you and your wife. So let's go get her.
Oh, boy.
Uh-oh.
It's about a guy who, for some reason I couldn't tell, becomes a cyborg. Like, in the trailer, his girlfriend screws on one of his limbs. It's awesome. But yeah. His sexy, brilliant robotics researcher girlfriend gets kidnapped by a weird evil albino. Oh, no! Now our hero has to track her down.
Albino's always evil.
Yeah, the real life.
Like, they really are creepy and evil. Like, they never are cast like the main character. Like, yeah. They're always the...
Every real life albino I've met has been super nice. This
really
is obviously
sorry,
a movie, you know, what's that, pink eyes?
Yeah.
But now our hero has to track her down, shooting grenades in midair and punching people through walls. The whole movie is in first-person view, and he has, like, never speaks. So it's like a 1990s first-person shooter. It's amazing, you guys. So excited. The downside is that the biggest actor that I can recognize in the trailer is Charlton Copley, who has a knack for acting in movies that range from to oh.
Is that an endorsement?
Yeah.
Are those positive sounds?
No. Fine. I wrote down meh to terrible.
Is that the Chappie guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the main character of District Meh.
Yeah. District Meh.
You know, the most interesting thing is that they cat food. I'll leave you with a text that I sent to my two action movie loving friends. Human speech cannot adequately convey how excited I am to see Hardcore Henry.
Who do you think would win in a fight, Hardcore Henry or Magic Mike?
Well, I think he'd punch him in the crotch so hard that he would fall through a wall. Okay. So Hardcore Henry wins.
Magic Mike would be more stylish, but I feel like this guy's got
I guess it's probably
badass.
He's got sexier moves. And it was from first-person perspective. You can't see the sexiness.
I'm rooting for Magic Mike. Yeah, there's always like, I'm an android. Humans outsmart them. That's how the movies go.
Yep.
Phil, what you got?
On February 28th, 2016, veteran character actor George Kennedy passed away at the age of 91. I was a huge fan of George Kennedy. And if you have yet to see the role George Kennedy won his Oscar for, now is the time. I'm talking about Cool Hand Luke, starring Paul Newman. The movie takes place on a prison work farm, and George Kennedy plays Dragline. He's sort of the head con of the camp, too. The friendship between Luke, played by Newman, and Dragline, played by Kennedy, to me is one of the most beautifully authentic film about friendship ever. And I hope we don't have failure to communicate.
I was about to reference that. Yes.
You need to watch Cool Hand Luke.
In between an egg eating contest.
Right.
That the
cutting the heads off.
The woman is washing the car and he's like, "Hello, see you." Oh my God. I will also say that he was very good in the Naked Gun movies.
Yeah, that's where I know him from. Yeah. He's the partner in Naked Gun.
I initially saw the Naked Gun movies, and then like, you know, when I became a man when I saw Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, when O.J. Simpson had the chase, when he's the first accused of what he did. And I was like, Nordberg, why? Because that's all I knew him from.
I must kill
the queen.
The queen. I frequently say, hey, it's Enrico Palazzo. Just because that's the kind of guy I am.
That's amazing.
And he's tied up and he's looking at
Can we do an all naked
gun? Yeah, let's do an all naked gun episode. Yeah.
I can't decide what is tickling my fancy the most this week, but I also don't want to talk about more than one thing. So I will talk about what I was going to talk about and then forget to talk about, which is the Netflix original series, Fuller House. This is a sequel series to the beloved family sitcom of the 80s and 90s, Full House. This is a show that is haunted by tragedy because the original premise of the original program is that Danny Tanner, played by Bob Saget, his wife is dead, and his brother-in-law and best friend move into the house to help him raise his three young daughters. In this new series, DJ Tanner from the original series, her husband is a fireman and dies in a fire, and her best friend, Kimmy Gibbler, and her sister move in to help her raise her three children. And so it is, like, unbelievably sad and, like, the corniest thing in the entire world. The pilot episode, the first episode, is, like, all throwbacks and, like, hey, let's everybody trot out their catchphrases. And
you got it, dude.
Yeah. The Olsen twins. It was, like, a minute into the episode. And then he's like, hey, I'm Boo-winkle. Oh. And then Mr. Woodchuck is, I'll slap my mouth. What? And I just did that.
Yeah, I was hoping you were ironically being excited about Fuller House.
I am not ironic. It is not. And I don't believe in guilty pleasures because, like, you shouldn't feel guilty about pleasure. And unless it's horrible. But I also,
I
like,
make it hotter.
I always loved Full House from, like, literally, like, the first episode. I watched it on a black and white television in my bedroom, and, like, always loved the show, fully aware that it is horrible and awful.
It's not horrible. You learn a lot of lessons.
Oh, you do. You learn a lot of stuff about it. Mike Love is awful.
Yes.
You know, Mike Love is an awful human being. And but this show is seriously like watching late era Full House when maybe it wasn't as good. But like the children on the show don't have the charm of the original cast, but the original cast, which is on the show, have somehow maintained the charm that they had on the original show. But now they're adults, and so they can make like slightly dirty jokes and then talk about drinking or whatever. It's only 13 episodes. I've almost watched all of it, and I look forward to it being over with. But I'm also enjoying it too. It's not, if that makes any sense.
No, okay. It doesn't. But nope. I have a question.
You don't want to bring me down?
I have a question.
Yes.
Who is Mike Love?
Mike Love is from the Beach Boys. Yes. He
that's what I thought.
He's the guy with the hat.
Okay.
And the Beach Boy, John Stamos, who played Uncle Jesse on the original show, who's a producer on the current show and also is a frequent guest star, played percussion with the Beach Boys. And so the Beach Boys appear during the Kokomo era, and the Beach the Beach Boys appeared.
I distinctly remember that.
That was a Beach Boys reference because they appeared on the original show.
Yeah, a couple times. Yeah.
Well, now correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Kokomo. Then that song wasn't it featured in the movie
Cocktail. It was on the Cocktail soundtrack. Yes. Yeah.
Where Tom Cruise tosses bottles.
Tosses bottles.
That's not a metaphor.
I never saw that Tom Cruise movie.
I had that soundtrack because
my sister went through a Tom Cruise phase. I watched a lot of Tom Cruise movies.
We all did.
I have a second question.
Yes.
Why is Mike Love terrible?
Because Mike Love is kind of tried to sort of squash the spirit of Brian Wilson and also take who is his cousin and, you know, and the mastermind behind the Beach Boys' greatest works, and also like kind of positions himself as the mastermind behind it, and
Wasn't there a movie last year that with Paul Dano?
Seen that. Love and Mercy.
Love and Mercy.
I haven't seen that.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Each era has like their like his nemesis, and Mike Love appears in the original, like, you know, with Paul Dano as young Brian Wilson, and he kind of like, you know, we're a beach surfing band. Why are you coming up with this weird crap?
Yeah,
it's not working.
Yeah, when they were trying to sort of, like many groups of that era, sort of trying to transition away from their we're all wearing the same shirt.
I blame
phase.
John Lennon.
I blame Yoko.
Like he wanted to. He was like, let's keep all the songs about cars and surfing. Like, and then Brian Wilson's like, no, I'm trying to express something bigger here.
Think about boats.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember when the Beach Boys got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? It was also the same years as the Supremes, but mm-hmm. Diana Ross didn't show up because there's obviously some bad blood there. Mm-hmm. And Mike Love just used his time to get up there and slam Diana Ross.
Yeah. See, there you go.
And wow.
You don't slam Diana Ross.
And then Bob Dylan got up and said, dude,
He also always wears a cap, like a cap. I just
brace your baldness.
Yep,
Mike. He's the Antichrist. Mike, what we're trying to say.
Yeah, wow. More like Mike Haight. Am I right?
The best thing about Mike Love is a friend of mine has a shirt.
Yeah, I can't win this episode.
A friend of mine has a shirt that says "Mike Love, not War," and that's I can get behind that because he's better than War.
Mike Love is my uncle.
Hey, they had Lowrider. They're amazing.
But speaking of pop music and top 40 music.
Excuse me. I got to go to the dance.
Run away. So speaking of popular music, tickling my fancy is the book The Song Machine by John Seabrook. It is a history of the electronically produced chart-topping pop song, in particular from the sort of late 90s, early aughts on. This, of course, is a time when supposedly the internet was going to decentralize the music business and there were going to be a series of long-tail micro-hits. That actually isn't what happened. There's these huge hits and just singles that sell more than any other singles in the past, even though the RIAA sometimes complains about piracy, which they didn't do on the Grammys this year, which I appreciated. But the book starts with profiles of Max Martin and Dennis Pop, the Swedish production team behind Britney Spears and the Backstreet Boys. And it goes on to talk about the other Scandinavian production team, Stargate, who produced a lot of Rihanna's records, and Dr. Luke, who produced a lot of tracks on Katy Perry and Kesha's albums. So what got me to this record actually was I couldn't find a lot of good writing about the case between Kesha and Dr. Luke, but the best stuff that was out there kept referencing this one book. So I went to it. It was actually really interesting. It talks about the transition between melody-based songs, the so-called track and hook songs, which basically have a beat and a chorus, and then they farm those out to other people to write melodies or lyrics for them. So, like, the melodies and the lyrics are just an afterthought. And it's really funny, too, because, like, I know these songs. I mean, they're ear candy. But I don't think I've ever really paid attention to what the actual, like, the song structures are. But I go back and listen to them. It's really funny. There's just a beat and a hook. There's really not a song there.
And if you look at, like, the cover, like, there's, like, 15 people listed as a songwriter in each one.
Yeah.
Because of that.
It's really funny, too, like, how many of the most popular songs are actually written by a few people. The other thing, it hasn't got into this in the book, but one of the things that does come up is that all of these guys are men and they sort of pick and choose which young women they want to decide to be pop stars. For me, it's actually, because I don't really pay attention to this music all that much, it's all new to me. It's a really interesting book. Especially too, what's really funny, for me is, someone who kind of likes experimental music or noise music or also dance music and, like, DJ music. And people are like, that's not even music. And, like, going back and listening to all of these pop songs intentionally for the first time, I can say, well, this really isn't music either. It's really funny. But anyway, it is a good book. I am enjoying it. There's a lot of stuff in there about Dr. Luke, if you want to learn about his career.
But I didn't think they talked about the Dr. Luke Kesha issue. They kind of just brushed it off to the side, and they're like, yeah, she says, and he says, and, you know, I didn't think that there was that much, because I've read this one, too.
Interesting.
But, ooh.
There's not a lot
rebuttal.
If that's your source for the Dr. Luke Kesha thing, I didn't think that it was that comprehensive. Like, they mentioned it, but...
So, news articles I've read about the Dr. Luke Kesha case referenced the book. In the book itself, and there's a hold list right now, but you can stream it immediately on Hoopla, which I and I'm like, there's an hour left in the audiobook, and we're right in the middle of the Dr. Luke chapter, So there's stuff about Dr. Luke's career mm-hmm. and his approach to music, not necessarily a lot of stuff about the case.
Yeah, they mentioned like that he worked with Kesha and that she was like mad about, and then they're just kind of like, oh, well, he's still a good musician. And, like, which is pretty much the music industry way of saying we don't care. And I mean, that's just their standard operating procedure. That's not new.
So I wasn't going to go there, but I thought it was interesting. I think that he does go out of the way to cite other people that said that Dr. Luke is a jerk. He says that one of the reasons that, like, you know, Dr. Luke makes track and hook is because he can't write melodies or lyrics, and he's pretty honest about that. So, anyway.
I guess for me, the number of people that are in the music industry that are jerks is high. So, like, it was just more white noise. I'm just like, they're like, oh, he's a jerk. I'm like, well, welcome to the music business.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, what little I know about it, it's exploiting the talent is kind of a thing.
White men exploiting young women. Yeah. I'm like, wait, that's not new. But I mean, I did think that I knew a little bit about like the Sweden, that group of, like, it went into more detail than I have been aware of. And didn't they talk about like the, I don't remember the term, like the Tokyo Pop or whatever? Like, didn't they have a section
about
like
J-pop? The
big section
J-pop,
about,
that's what it is. Oh. Thank you.
Big section about K-pop.
Korean?
The Korean pop, yeah.
Really? Why? Do they do the same thing over there?
Because
it's manufactured. I mean, it's very manufactured.
I believe it was Perlman, the guy that put together the Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
I think he saw K-pop artists when he was traveling, and he was like, I need to do that. And then even though he wasn't in the music business at all, he actually used to rent blimps for promotional purposes.
This is coming back to me. My sister is very much into the Backstreet Boys, and I had to hear so much about.
So he's like, I need to do this. So he created the Backstreet Boys after that. He's interviewed extensively from prison.
From prison.
In the book.
Prison?
Oh, yeah. He got arrested for tax evasion. And he was not responsible.
You know, if there's one thing that I didn't like about the book is there is a lot of salacious stuff about the celebrities in the book, which I really didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, that didn't add to. What I liked about was like, these are the producers that make this music, and this is how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all the people that they've worked with. Because even like Stargate, if you look on Wikipedia, they're like, here are the list of singles that have cracked the top 10. I mean, it's like 50 songs. It's like, whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because Max Martin that he just, Mac Taylor's 1989 album, didn't he do that out? Like, that's the first time he's worked with her. Is it him or was it? Because the other guy died. Dennis guy died.
Yeah, so Max Martin and Dennis Pop were sort of partners, and then Max Martin he worked with other people, but now Max Martin and Dr. Luke work together a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, in the big meta-narrative, people often say Dr. Luke replaced Dennis Pop as Max Martin's production
collaborator.
Pop. But as you point out, there's, like, these songs are, like, made by committee, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I don't want to spoil it too much, but the whole part about Esther Dean is, like,
I love that part.
Just amazing. Yeah. So, like, I don't want to split, but there's a person who hears the tracks, improvises hooks, like almost like scatting. They decide what's going to be a good hook and they put it on the track.
And she's in Pitch Perfect.
She's in Pitch Perfect,
So.
Wow.
I just want to say too, this book is a perfect companion piece to Let's Talk About Love, A Journey to the End of Taste by Carl Wilson, the 33 and a third book about, not only the Celine Dion phenomenon and why people he hates Celine Dion, at least at first before he started writing the book, and like he wants to figure out like why people like that music, and it's actually like a de facto history of popular music, and it's almost like where that book stops, this book keeps going. They work very well together. They're both really short.
I read it after I read Mike was talking about how music was free, so I read that one and then I read this one, so it was kind of two sides of the same coin.
That's why I'm interested. It's like, this does sound kind of like a good companion piece.
Yeah.
That's The Song Machine by John Seabrook.
Corrections!
It's weather day.
Corrections?
I don't got none.
I have one. I said Hilly Crystal was thrice bankrupt, but he was only twice bankrupt.
Oh, so much better.
And also, because I talked about this earlier in the show, I don't want to bring us down.
Dun, 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 dun.
But we haven't played the Don't Want to Bring You Down card in a while, so maybe someone will play it on someone today.
On-air production meeting, you guys want to keep doing that? I kind of, it seemed like to me that it had just faded out naturally.
Yeah, I kind of got tired of the cards after a while.
I like the cards, but I just forgot that we had done it. That's all.
I try not to be a jerk and, like, you know, poo-poo on people's joy.
Well, I poo-poo
I'm trying
away,
not.
Well, you
know, trying to be a better person.
I think the idea is when there's a clear, like, someone is saying X, but I think negative X is like when, you know, like a clear, like, like 180 opinion disagreement, right?
Yes.
Like, that's fair, but you're wrong.
Yeah, go for it. I think, too, it seemed like sometimes, too, we were, like, you would play the I don't want to bring it down card if you disagreed with somebody else. Where it seems like sometimes we would play them if we were, like, calling out someone's, like, hypocrisy. You said this before, but now you're saying this. So I'm playing it for you or on you, where it would be like, I think the intention was, I am playing my don't want to bring you down card because I disagree with whatever you're saying.
Hmm.
Right. What was the other one? Was the snob card.
Snob card. That was my favorite.
Or like, I am intentionally going to be snobby on the pop culture podcast on purpose. Though
we'll each have a full deck of snob cards. Some of these episodes go.
It was extremely enlightening and amusing for me to see what y'all thought
was snobby.
So that was interesting to me. But
well, you know, Kierkegaard says.
Kierkegaard, Schmierkegaard.
Yeah.
Any other
the
corrections?
The soul is a construct.
Is this on-air production meeting over? Any other corrections?
Nope.
I kind of wanted to one of the things I wanted to get in there but didn't get in is, like, I want to change the Rick Roll meme to, instead of Rick Ashley, to, like, clips of Alan Rickman saying snobby things to you.
It's Rick Astley.
Yeah, whatever. Great.
Future correction.
Snob card. Don't care about that.
Would it still be singing the Never Gonna Give You Up song, but like with
no.
the Alan Rickman?
I want him to be
that,
like,
oh, that one.
Never gonna give you up.
Never going to give you up.
That could be a few months down the road, like, after, you know. Like, first step, we have to insert Alan Rickman clips instead of Rick Astley.
Astley.
I believe it is Astley.
It rhymes with ghastly.
You're not wrong about that.
It was a Nick Lowe song. He rhymes it.
I
just want to tell you how I'm feeling.
That song's going to be in my head all day now. Thank you.
Sorry.
Your brain has been Rickrolled.
Since we've already got a flat tire and driven off the road, I wanted to tell Amanda that if I ever say, you should see this movie, if I say this, I can't talk about these. Well, if I ever say you should see this movie, it's because I think that you will enjoy it. Not for some, you know, canonical... I think that it's something that I think that you would enjoy.
I have no respect for the canon.
I'm not going to tell Amanda that, like, this doesn't follow comic book protocol, so it's obviously garbage. I don't think she cares.
No, I would play my snob card on that. Snob card. Although
right.
I do want to go back and read
for more information about how to produce a podcast.
You can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Andy.
Speaking of producing podcasts, if you wanted to subscribe to this podcast and get it every week automatically, where would you go?
iTunes, Stitcher, RSS feeds.
Thank you. All right. You got it.
That was very complete.
Pass
Mike.
The test.
I subscribe on Stitcher. It's pretty neat seeing a podcast I'm on get updated every now and then.
I'm on iTunes.
I am a computer nerd. I just use the old-fashioned RSS feed. Next week.
Kid stuff.
Because we're Flintstone
no
kids.
No more writing, no more books, no more teachers dirty. We'll be right back.
Three's Company, right?
That is Sanford and
Son.
Which is sort of the exact opposite of Three's Company.
Come and knock on my door.
Come on, knock on my door.
They've been waiting for you.
You were singing the second funkiest theme song of all time.
What's the first funkiest?
That would be the Jeffersons TV theme.
Moving on up.
Yep, see? Actually, I don't know.
We should have an episode where we just sing TV
songs. Sanford and Son might be the
all-time best.
My favorite
Golden
theme
Girls.
Song is Round the Prisoner.
That's a pretty great song.
Prisoner.
Watch out, white ball.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel.